26 temporary shelters this year.
Syrian Foreign Ministry officials asserted that the government continues to repair the infrastructure and restore basic services to areas liberated by the Syrian government from terror, noting to some obstacles in the face of refugees, such as U.S. and Turkish occupation of Syrian soil, support to terrorist groups, and looting natural resources.
The Syrian government continues to take all measures for Syrians' return. Our efforts are faced by some conspiring countries' attempts to take advantage of the refugees' issue politically and exercise systematic misleading campaign that the situation is unstable, as well as lies that refugees are in danger if they return.
Russian President's special envoy told Press TV that the West started to realize they should shift their policy towards Syrians' repatriation.
Western countries were doing everything possible, and there was huge information and campaign against what has been done here, you know, and they were trying just to convince everybody that the conditions are not ready for the Syrian refugees to return. It comes to this, to the understanding of the Western countries, that they have to start to be more active themselves now. I think that's a good start. It takes, they need time, of course, because they cannot just change completely their policy.
11 agreements and one contract have been prepared to be signed between Syria and Russia in the fields of education, medicine, culture, science, and industry. The gradual restoration of relations between Syria and the Arab world, as well as the enhancement of economic ties with the country's neighbors, constitute a spark of hope for all Syrian refugees that their homeland started its journey of recovery from war, a fact that represents a solid encouragement for their return. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
Wailing and crying, seeking the dead body of their beloved son, the relatives of Mudassir Gul, a doctor by profession, was killed on Monday, along with other civilian and two fighters, during a gun battle in Srinagar.
Authorities say he was involved with fighter and killed in crossfire. We know he was an innocent. Now that he is dead, at least return his dead body. The police have denied us his last rights.
The military operation took place on Monday evening in Srinagar, the main city of Muslim-majority Kashmir. According to police reports, the fighters had holed up in a building in the Hyderabad area and were eliminated by the government forces. The Inspector General of Kashmir Police, while talking to the media, said,
"The building owner was killed in a crossfire, while the fourth person was an overground worker, OGW, who was provided his rented space to Haider, foreign fighter, for using the same as militant hideout."
The building owner's daughter, however, accuses the government forces of using his father as a human shield.
"Security forces took my father inside the building, not once but thrice. On the third turn, he did not return, and they say he was killed in crossfire. Now that they have killed my innocent father, they must return his dead body."
The police chief said, fearing law and order problems, the dead bodies were not handed over to the families for last rites.
"It is not sure whether a militant bullet or the bullets fired by forces hit him. It would be clear after investigations whose bullet hit him."
Following the COVID-19 pandemic protocol, the authorities in Indian-controlled Kashmir have denied the last rites to the families of fighters killed during the military operations in Kashmir since 2020. Dozens of fighters have been buried at far-off locations, guarded and inaccessible to families. More recently, Kashmir's tallest pro-freedom leader, Sayyid Ali Gilani's family, was also denied his last rights, something for which New Delhi was highly criticized.
Although having a decent burial is a fundamental right, here in Kashmir, it is seen as a breeding ground for anti-India sentiments and irregularities. Human rights defenders say denying families a proper funeral for their loved ones is a gross violation of human rights and a reason for unending pain for their kin. Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iran's envoy for Afghanistan, Hassan Kazemi Qomi, has arrived in Kabul for talks on mutual and regional issues. This is the first time that a high-ranking Iranian delegation is visiting Afghanistan since the takeover of the country by the Taliban in August. In an address to reporters upon his arrival in Kabul airport, the Iranian envoy said he would meet senior Taliban officials, adding that security and economic issues would top the agenda. He stressed that two neighboring countries need to expand their ties in all areas.
Afghanistan has been destroyed by invaders over the past decades. Now it's time to rebuild the country. We will help our Afghan brothers rebuild their country. A secure Afghanistan can contribute to regional stability. Afghanistan and Iran should have safe borders and expand their economic ties amid U.S. sanctions. We also need to cooperate in the fight against terrorism, as our enemies are conducting proxy wars after their repeated defeats in the region.
On the other hand, the Taliban have voiced their interest in the expansion of ties with Iran. They vow to continue their talks with the aim of increasing mutual cooperation.
Iran's move to send its special envoy means that the country is seeking to establish normal relations with us and increase the level of cooperation between the two sides. We have many things in common, particularly when it comes to border security and economic exchanges, so we have to continue our talks.
Tehran has stressed the necessity to establish an inclusive government in Afghanistan, representing all sections of Afghan society. Iran has repeatedly condemned any form of terrorism in Afghanistan and expressed its deep concerns over the fate of Afghan civilians, particularly following the recent terrorist attacks which left hundreds of Shia Afghans dead or wounded. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Israel has always touted its intelligence agency as invulnerable, but a spate of recent hacking attacks against the regime has undermined the narrative. A hacking group which calls itself Moses' Staff has released a video saying it has successfully carried out a massive cyber attack on Israel and broken into the servers of its major companies. The group says it is now in possession of comprehensive data which include information on the location and properties of the regime's sensitive and vital systems across the occupied Palestinian territories. The data also includes airborne mapping surveys with 5-centimeter accuracy and three-dimensional images of Israeli military sites. Moses' Staff is the third group of its kind that has exclusively hacked Israeli organizations and released confidential information of high-ranking military officials in cyberspace in recent months. Such cyber attacks have exposed the weakness of Israel's spying apparatus. But such incidents are just the tip of the iceberg. In September, six Palestinian inmates escaped from one of Israel's highest security jails, which was described by Palestinian resistance groups as a major intelligence failure. Following Israel's 11-day war on Gaza in May, the regime's intelligence and spying fiasco also made headlines. This was due to severe blows the regime received after Palestinians fired thousands of rockets into Israel. At that time, Palestinian media said the Israeli spying services could not predict Hamas and Islamic Jihad movement's tactics to beat the regime's most wanted Iron Dome system. Israeli media also called for a purge of the regime's military leaders for their role in the failed war on Gaza. Such failures come amid internal divisions inside Mossad. Recently, three senior Mossad officials stepped down over what was cited as organizational changes by the agency's new chief, David Barnea. However, Israeli media have described their resignations as an earthquake. Such a description has highlighted major setbacks Mossad has suffered not only in field operations but also in cyberspace. The blows that Israel has received have further shattered the image of its invulnerability.
A weekend terror incident in Liverpool, UK. One man killed, one injured, and four aged between 20 and 29 arrested under the controversial counter-terrorism law. The mood among some, one of shock and disbelief.
Honestly, shock. You know, I couldn't believe it. I've never been around anything like this in my life. I moved up here just for uni, so to have something happen like this, you know, right next to my accommodation is very scary.
Police say the passenger, 32-year-old Iman Al-Suwaylmin, carried a homemade explosive device into the taxi. The driver, David Perry, who locked the suspect in the car to prevent a worse situation, escaped with minor injuries. The timing has had everyone thinking, just 2 minutes before Remembrance Sunday, when the entire country remembers Britons killed in wars. In Monday, the government raised the terror threat level from substantial to severe, warning residents to be vigilant.
The police have now confirmed that this is being treated as a terrorist attack, and while the investigation continues at pace, you will understand that I can't comment on the details of the case or its motivation. but it is a stark reminder of the need for us all to remain utterly vigilant.
There are still three police cordons in the city, one here at the Women's Hospital, the site of the explosion, and the two major streets elsewhere. Police are still investigating to establish the circumstances of what happened. Police are still searching two addresses for more clues into the motivation behind the incident. Saeed Puriza, Liverpool.
The violence in Myanmar was not enough for us, says the desperate woman upon our arrival. She says we are calling God in every possible way, but looks like our prayers are not being heard. She has many complaints, yet she can talk about the basic ones.
There is a huge list of problems that we are facing, but the major issue is every one of us has not received free COVID vaccination, and many had to spend their own money to get those. Another major hurdle is the lack of toilets for us and shortage of water supply. With regards to food, God sends many good people to feed us almost every day.
After fleeing war-ravaged Myanmar and what the UN described as ethnic cleansing, they are now trying to rebuild their shattered lives in different parts of India. But in India, they are sometimes called termites, sometimes illegal immigrants. Apparently, they are also accused of illegal activities, but these claims were not reflected in the recently released National Crime Records Bureau analysis.
Vasudeva Kutumbakam, which means the world is one family, sounds like an encouraging phrase. But looking at the living conditions of these refugees leads one to ask question whether the world has abandoned its responsibility towards them.
Rohingya refugees are struggling to survive in the world's largest democracy with enormous quantities of effort. Over the last few years, the community is in utter distress, sometimes detention in midnight raids, sometimes their camps being mysteriously burnt down. Regardless of the refugee crisis across the world, this particular community continues to be unseen victims of violence.
Since our camp was razed down by fire, we have relocated to this place, and it's a very difficult situation in terms of living in crumbling space. We are having shortage of water supplies. A tanker arrives and it finishes within an hour. Another major issue is snakes on this land and the lack of toilets for women.
Official estimates suggest more than 40,000 Rohingya Muslims have sought refuge in India after a brutal crackdown against their community in Myanmar. Many refugees say they felt safe in India since they arrived, but over the last few years, a vicious campaign against their expulsion is haunting the community.
In an interview released by Al-Qaeda's media, the leader of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, Khalid Batarfi, admitted that the terrorists have been fighting forces of Yemen's Ansarullah movement on 11 fronts. Batarfi said the role in fighting the Houthi fighters is clear and no one can deny it. This raises a fresh speculation about the cooperation between the Saudi-led forces and the Al-Qaeda terrorists, previously reported by media, including the 2016 battle for Taiz.
Al-Qaeda leaders' confession of their participation in the battles against the Yemeni army confirms our earlier remarks that there is a strategy taken by the Saudi-led coalition using terrorists to support its mercenaries, and this confession may be through which the Al-Qaeda leader is trying to prove their presence and that they have a role in a battle that has been going on for years. We will continue to liberate all Yemeni lands from terrorist organizations, whether in Marib or elsewhere.
Experts say the U.S. has been using and supporting terrorist groups in Yemen since the beginning of the Saudi-led war, just as it has supported the Saudi war on Yemen. They say the Yemeni army has proven this by seizing caches of weapons bearing USAID logos in Al-Qaeda arms depots.
The U.S. is the main supporter of Al-Qaeda, Daesh, and all terrorist organizations, and it seeks to control the countries in which the terrorists are present. When it comes to Yemen, Al-Qaeda failed in this, and the Yemeni army managed to expel the terrorists from their main stronghold in Al-Baida Governorate. The Yemeni army found tons of U.S.-made weapons in Al-Qaeda's warehouses in Al-Baida, and this is another proof that the United States is the main supporter of terrorist organizations.
Earlier this year, Yemen's Interior Ministry also said Al-Qaeda terrorists are fighting alongside Saudi-backed forces in Yemen's Marib province, where the Yemeni army is pressing ahead with a liberation offensive, which Riyadh denied.
The statement by the Al-Qaeda leader shines a new light on how the Saudi-led war has helped prop up terrorist groups in Yemen with the help of the U.S. Yemenis, however, believe that their army will eventually liberate the entire territory of their country from terrorist groups and occupiers. Abdul Latif Al-Washal, Sana'a.
Listening to IRIB English Radio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, Make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepest me alive. And make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kaveh Tawhi. The use of sanctions as blind instruments to pressure nations. That is one accusation that has been leveled against the UN, an international body that was created to resolve world crises, not to be a tool by mostly Western veto-wielding members to be used against other nations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine the shortfalls of the UN Security Council, the reforms that many are asking for the Council to go through, particularly why it has been used as a tool for political gains.
The Security Council is one of the six primary organs of the United Nations, created after the Second World War. The Council has wide-ranging powers, including the approval of changes to UN charters, enacting international sanctions, and even authorizing military action. The UNSC is arguably the most powerful UN organ because it is the only one with the ability to pass binding resolutions. Hence, it would not be an exaggeration to say its decisions could have global impact. However, despite its immense importance, the Council is anything but inclusive. Although the UN General Assembly has more than 190 members, only 15 are in the Security Council. Of those, 10 gain their seats on a rotating basis, while only five countries, namely the United States, the United Kingdom, France, Russia, and China, are permanent members with veto powers. This puts enormous power in the hands of only a few governments, which have time and again shown they are not afraid of using it. In the past, the Council has imposed sanctions on countries like Libya, North Korea, and Yemen. Iran, also a victim of UNSC sanctions, has censured the Council's use of such restrictions under unsubstantiated pretexts. Tehran's UN ambassador on Tuesday described sanctions as blunt and blind instruments that raise fundamental ethical questions. He said the sanctions should be reserved as a last resort, but right now they are being used as a tool of collective punishment.
In the past, certain Security Council sanctions have served only to collectively punish an entire nation, without any actual positive impact on the maintenance of international peace and security.
Furthermore, the Iranian ambassador criticized the UNSC's makeup. He declared that the Council must be reformed to ensure equitable rather than geographical representation. He also slammed the disproportionate presence and power of Western nations in the influential organ.
Currently, the West has a strong presence and influence in the Council. Three of its members have veto power, while the main regions are fully represented in terms of both the number as well as privileges, including veto power. This means inequality among the regions.
The stated goal of the Security Council is to maintain international peace and security, but on numerous occasions it has in fact acted as an obstacle in the way of justice. For instance, the veto-wielding United States has blocked the passage of over 50 resolutions critical of Israel's policies since 1972, and U.S.-backed Israel too has defied dozens of resolutions on its crimes against Palestinians with impunity. The Security Council's far-reaching jurisdiction makes its importance hard to overstate. That significance is perhaps exactly what makes the Council's overhaul more needed in the current circumstances.
Well, I guess joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Alfred de Zayas, who's a former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. Also joining us is Macharia Munen, a UN expert on decolonization, who joins us on the phone from Nairobi.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, let me first start with you, Alfred Zayas, if I may. And I would like to ask whether you agree with this stance on the UN, that it is a truly representative, effective, transparent, accountable, and above all, rules-based body.
If I could, in my 14 reports to the Human Rights Council and the General Assembly, I frequently identified the obstacles exactly to being such an effective rules-based organization. My former boss, Secretary General Kofi Annan, was one of the first to recognize the problems and to propose very concrete reforms to the United Nations in general and in particular to the Security Council. In my 2013 report to the General Assembly, I also laid out a plan of action how to reform the system, how to reform the Security Council, and I reflect that, by the way, in my new publication, Building a Just World Order, which also includes 25 principles of international order. Of course, we can and must reform the United Nations. But obviously, those five powers that possess not only permanent membership, but also the veto power, are not likely to give up their privileges that easy. Article 108 of the UN Charter allows for amending the Charter. It has been used before. The size of the council, for instance, has been increased. Kofi Annan proposed that it be increased from 15 to 25, and obviously that means that major countries like India and Brazil and Japan also have a claim to membership in the Security Council. Whether they would ever get the veto power is something else. Initially, I used to be very critical of the veto power. On the other hand, I remember a debate I had in the General Assembly, and the Russian ambassador at the time took me to task because I said, look, if we didn't have the veto power, NATO countries would go ahead and bombard the rest of the world and call it legal because it would be approved by the Security Council. And then he said, look, we made a mistake back in 2011 when supposedly humanitarian assistance was going to be given to Libya. And instead of humanitarian assistance, what NATO did was to bomb the hell out of it. That was Resolution 1973, which went through not with the approval of Russia and China, but with their abstention. So in the future, clearly, the Soviet Union, or rather Russia, and China have blocked supposedly humanitarian intervention resolutions tabled, for instance, against Syria. And that is understandable. So if you're going to do away with the veto power, make sure that that doesn't open the floodgates for indiscriminate attacks under Chapter 7. It is Chapter 6 of the UN Charter that should be used, which is the Charter on Pacific Settlement of Disputes.
All right, let's bring in Macharia Munin into this. Macharia Munin, our guest there talked about one example, and that was the Libya case, and also he talked about the veto power. In your assessments or in your recollection, what perhaps has led to calls for reforms for the UN? What examples can you give us, or reasons that you think the UN needs to be reformed? And where did it go wrong that this call was made? Because it's been in the works for quite some time, the calls for reform for the UNSC.
That different. When the UN Security Council was formed back in 1945, the logic of it was that the Security Council was there to protect the interests of the then big powers. That's why they gave themselves veto, that they were the one to determine what is safe for the world, and in case any of their interests were to be infringed by global democracy, then they gave themselves the power to reject global democracy. So the environment of the 1945 after World War II is now very different. We have more countries, we have more assertive interests coming into field, and we have seen over time that the big powers of the day that time, which appeared to be in agreement, are no longer working together. They do not look after the interest of the world. Instead, they look after their perceived interest. And sometimes they make decisions that would otherwise not be acceptable just because they are big. The example given about the invasion of Libya through the UN Security Council's supposed resolution is an example of that. Of course, there have been issues of vetoes when it comes to what Israel does or does not do. And in the days of the Cold War, there appeared to have been competitions between the United States and the Soviet Union as to who can veto more than the other the UN resolutions. So now, with the increasing talk of global democracy, and it is an increasing talk of global democracy, then the idea that one country can veto the world interest becomes obnoxious. We also have a few more countries that feel that they are strong enough to be in the big boys club. So you have Brazil, you have India, you have Japan, you have Germany, which are big economic powers, but they are not acceptable because they were supposedly not there in 1945, or they were on the wrong side of the big powers of the day. Today, some of them are seen to be good countries, yet they are not acceptable into the Security Council as permanent members. The challenge that comes is convincing the five permanent members that they should expand their numbers and dilute their own power is a very challenging thing.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things that Alfred Desaias, I'm curious as to how it can be solved in terms of the fair distribution of a say for countries that do not have representation, in a matter of speaking, or even continents. I mean, you're looking at the five countries that have the veto power. Is this the major, you think, problem that the UN has? Because when you have the Middle East, or we call West Asia, or Africa not having that representation, then what can be done? Adding countries to the list, is that a solution?
Solution.
This is for Alfred Desaias. Alfred Desaias, this question is for you. Go ahead.
Well, I fully agree with what my colleague, Professor Macharia Munene, just said. Beyond that, obviously, just a numerical increase of the Security Council will make it somewhat more equitable, somewhat more representative of the world. But what you want also is what Ambassador Majid Tanta Ramanchi said, to address the ethical issues that are involved. There, about a third of the population of the world is suffering under illegal unilateral coercive measures, which have been condemned by the General Assembly and have been condemned by the Human Rights Council repeatedly. What the international community has to do, and that is the responsibility of the General Assembly, is to elevate the issue to the highest judicial instance of the United Nations, being the International Court of Justice. And it is quite clear to me that sanctions kill. Not only do sanctions kill, but they kill hundreds of thousands of people. Because that is that, it should be declared not only illegal, because it is of course illegal, but a crime against humanity. And then that should be referred on to the International Criminal Court to prosecute those countries that have imposed sanctions on other countries which suffer, they're crippled, for instance, in the battle against COVID-19, and their economies are asphyxiated. So that has to be addressed, and these are ethical issues. These are issues of human rights, of the right to life, of the right to food, of the right to water, etc. So back to the reform proposals. Yes, let's increase the membership from 15 to 25, but there are many other mechanisms that must be put in place.
Uh-huh.
There is, by the way, a working group of the General Assembly that is looking, and has been looking for the last 15 years, looking at reform. But of course that gets systematically blocked by those who are not interested in reform.
Sure.
But the possibility is there, Article 108 of the UN Charter, which provides for amendment.
Macharia Munene, let's look at a case in point here when it comes to sanctions. And that would be no better place to start with than the Islamic Republic of Iran. When you take a look at what has been leveled against Iran in terms of sanctions, the story obviously is very long. But my question to you is, do you think that using Iran as an example, that you have three of the five countries that have the veto power to have leveled sanctions against Iran for their own political gains? That is one of the critiques that has been leveled against the UN when it comes to Iran, specifically those three countries, in order to achieve whatever objectives they have by their use of sanctions, which Iran deems illegal.
The sanctions, in many instances, are placed on technicalities, many of them illegal. We do have, I think, in the case of Iran at present, there are some, but were largely imposed by the last administration, the U.S. administration, which negated its own treaty on what had been agreed. And the interesting thing is that the new administration, U.S. administration, continues to stick to those sanctions. I'm not very willing to review the whole thing. But sanctions are politically driven moves by powerful countries that use the United Nations as an instrument of their own foreign policy. So in this case, the three powers with the veto capacity are the United Nations, who are also negotiating involved in the Iran treaty on nuclear activities. It is a political tool, and this should be understood that way. As to whether or not there can be reforms, we can demand reforms. In fact, it is an attitude thing, and it is for the General Assembly collectively to come together and shame the ones who are standing on the way of reform, and to point out that the sanctions which are targeted for the wrong reasons are actually tantamount to criminality in the global thinking. But that mind frame of the big powers, that they have to protect themselves irrespective of what is what needs to be, it's unethical, but it's a moral issue, and they need to be ashamed in order to see sense that they should accommodate other people.
Okay, Alfred Zayas, I'm going to ask you whether you can guess what entity we're talking about here. And this question that I have for you is that since the inception of the council, this would be the UN HRC, okay? Since its inception in the year 2006, it has issued 142 condemnations against UN member states. Out of the 142, 95 was leveled against, and I'm wondering if you know who that would be.
Well, the United Nations Human Rights Council does have a focus on Israel, and it does have a permanent item on its agenda on Israel, so it's no surprise that there are so many resolutions adopted against Israel. On the other hand, you have to consider that since 1967, there is a Security Council resolution 242 that condemned the occupation of Palestine territories by Israel, and that in 2004 the International Court of Justice issued a very clear, long advisory opinion on the illegality of Israeli actions in Palestine territories, in particular the building of the wall, and that Israel has flouted countless resolutions of the General Assembly and of the Human Rights Council. So, hello. I mean, you cannot be part of the international community and continue flouting the violations, or rather the resolutions that have been adopted, telling you to correct the situation. That's why the General Assembly, surely the Security Council will not adopt resolutions against Israel, because they will be vetoed either by the United States, the United Kingdom, or France. On the other hand, the General Assembly can here take the lead and in particular elevate a number of legal issues under Article 96 of the UN Charter. The General Assembly can ask the International Court of Justice to rule on some of these issues. And I'm saying not only Israel, also on the issue of collective punishment.
Sure. But my point here was when you have the incident that happened at the end of October, and let me make sure that I get this right, where you have at the UNGA, you have the Israeli ambassador to the UN, Gilad Erdan, at the podium there tear up that report. It just shows that Israel doesn't want to follow international laws, which it keeps breaking, and resolutions are leveled against it. That was the point that I was trying to get at. Unfortunately, we just are fresh out of time. I do have to end this spotlight, but thank you, Alfred Zayas, former UN Special Rapporteur on the promotion of a democratic and equitable international order. And the name of your book is A Just World Order, which is the book by Desaias. Also, Macharia Munen, thank you, UN expert on decolonization from Nairobi. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tathway, it's goodbye until next time.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. Indigenous peoples came to COP26 summit in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. Now that it is over, we don't see the path forward we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. The article you're about to hear has been written by Victoria Tauri-Corpuz, the director of Tepteba Foundation, Indigenous Peoples International Center for Policy Research and Education in the Philippines. It has been published in the opinion section of the British newspaper The Guardian. The piece is titled, Indigenous Peoples Had a Clear Vision for COP26, but it has not been delivered. Indigenous peoples came to COP26 in Glasgow with clear goals that we wanted to see reflected in the final results. But now that it is over, we don't see the path forward that we were hoping for. There is still too much wrangling between the developed and the developing countries, with the developed nations blocking much-needed agreements on rights and funding. And overall progress towards implementing the commitments made in the Paris Agreement is too slow. We wanted to ensure that the decisions included the need to respect human rights, including Indigenous peoples' rights, in undertaking adaptation, mitigation, and loss and damage measures to deal with the immediate effects of the climate crisis. We also wanted COP26 to adopt the local communities and Indigenous peoples platform, as agreed by the Facilitative Working Group, an initiative that would ensure Indigenous peoples and their knowledge would be included in the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change process. It is vital that Indigenous peoples are able to directly access finance, so that when they undertake actions on the climate crisis, it is from a position of strength, and they are ensured the protection of rights to own, to control and manage territories, especially their forests. It was also our view that Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market mechanisms for emissions trading and offsets should include us when these are designed and implemented, and our rights should be protected. also that an international grievance mechanism be established, which we can use in case our rights are violated in the implementation of Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord. I'm happy to see the preamble of the COP26 cover decision states that parties respect, promote and consider their respective obligations on human rights, the right to health, the rights of indigenous peoples. This decision also recognizes and acknowledges the important role of stakeholders, including indigenous peoples, in averting, minimizing and addressing loss and damage associated with the adverse effects of climate change. The decision also recognizes the importance of protecting, conserving and restoring ecosystems to deliver crucial services, including acting as a net carbon sink, reducing vulnerability to climate change impacts and supporting sustainable livelihoods, including for indigenous peoples and for local communities. When several countries and philanthropic donors committed $1.7 billion to indigenous peoples to protect their forests, I voiced my hope that these resources would be effectively and directly accessed by indigenous peoples and not go through intermediaries such as states or the big conservation organizations. A protocol was adopted, which, if effectively implemented, means indigenous peoples and local communities will be able to further develop and strengthen the use of their traditional knowledge, practices, and innovation on climate change mitigation and adaptation. That decision emphasized the important role of indigenous peoples and local communities, culture, and knowledge in effective action on climate change, urging parties to actively involve indigenous peoples and local communities. Article 6 of the Paris Climate Accord on market and non-market-based mechanisms for mitigation mentions the need to respect indigenous peoples' rights, but does not mention the need to obtain our free, prior, and informed consent. We hoped for an international grievance mechanism, but that was downgraded. So some good was done in Glasgow, but there were many inadequacies, such as the agreement to phase down rather than phase out coal production, even if it was an advance to see coal mentioned for the first time in a COP decision. The biggest coal producers and coal users, such as China, the United States of America, Australia, and India, also did not sign on an earlier pledge to end the use of coal power. With this, it is difficult to imagine that the 1.5 degrees Celsius temperature rise goal will be achieved. What we need is for countries who are contributing most to greenhouse gas emissions to be serious in cutting back on fossil fuel production. For us, in developing countries, the capacity of our government to adapt and mitigate is directly dependent on the provision of finance from the rich world. And yet, the commitment to deliver $100 billion every year from 2020 was not reaffirmed. We, the indigenous peoples, will continue to do our duties and fulfill our obligations to Mother Earth and to our future generations. But we will be able to do these much better if our collective rights to our lands, to our territories and resources, to culture and to our traditional knowledge, practices and innovations are respected and protected. Many lives of indigenous leaders and activists have been sacrificed, nurturing the ecosystem the world needs. COP26 summit didn't do enough to set us on a clear path to 1.5 degrees Celsius rise or to allow vulnerable countries and vulnerable people to adapt to the ongoing crisis.
Good morning.
Of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is